Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Pandora's Legions by Christopher Anvil. Edited by Eric Flint. Narrated by Wayne Mitchell. Part 1. Pandora's Planet. Clyde Horsip, planetary integrator, prided himself on being much more than a jailer. Each advance of the Integral Union meant more occupied planets, and each one of these planets, like a single tiny component in a giant magnet, must be brought into line with the rest. This was Clyde Horsip's job, and he settled to it now with relish.
"Phase one is complete," he insisted, emphasizing the word.
Brack Moffus, the military overseer, smiled ruefully.
"Not quite as complete as it often is on these humanoid planets."
"Then give me a brief summary of the details,"
said Horsip. He cast a quick glance out the landing boat's window at the curve of the blue and green world below.
"Looks promising enough."
"Well," said Moffus, "as far as that goes, it is. It's a Centra-type planet, mean diameter about 0.8 with gravity, oxygen, and temperature ideally suited to human and humanoid life. The percentage of water surface is higher than on Centra, about 75%, but it's well distributed and helps moderate the climate. There are plenty of minerals, including massive quantities of deep nickel iron that hasn't yet been touched."
Horsip nodded. "And the inhabitants?"
"The usual types of planet and animal life, and the humanoids."
"Ah, we come to the main point. What stage were the humanoids in when you landed?"
Brack Moffus looked at Horsip and gave a wry smile.
"Technologically," said Moffus, "they were very near Centra, 0.9, and in some areas higher."
"You aren't serious." The military overseer shook his head and looked away.
"You wouldn't ask me that if you'd been in on the invasion. Perhaps you've heard of Centralis II?
"The Hell Planet! Who hasn't heard of it?"
Horsip let his voice show impatience.
"What of it?"
"Well," said Moffus, "that gives us ground for comparison. This was worse. 30% of the initial landing parties were vaporized the first day. Another 50% had their sites eliminated by the second day, and were pinned to the Earth that day or the day after. The whole second wave had to funnel through the remaining 20% of sites in isolated regions, and of course, that meant the natives retained effective control of the situation everywhere it counted. If you'll imagine yourself wrestling one of the giant snakes of Goa, you'll have a good idea of our position."
He raised a hand as Horsip, frowning, started to speak.
"Let me summarize. 30% of our selected sites were eliminated, 50% were in desperate straits, and the remaining 20% were jam-packed, overloaded, and only meant for secondary purposes in the first place. All this, mind you, despite the fact that the natives let off a couple of incomplete attacks on each other during the initial stages."
"Hysteria?"
scowled Horsip.
"Regional rivalries," said Moffus.
"Well," said Horsip, "give the censorship another silver nova for efficiency. All I ever heard of this was that it was proceeding according to schedule."
"It was," said Moffus, "but it wasn't our schedule."
"I see," said Horsip, his face disapproving. "Well, what did you do?"
"Organized our established sites as fast as possible and improvised new ones in chosen locations, connecting the outer sites to form a defensive perimeter."
"Defensive?"
"That was what it boiled down to."
"What about the other sites, the 50% under attack?"
"We supplied them as well as we could. When we were built up enough, we started a heavy thrust to split the enemy, native forces, and at the same time ordered a simultaneous breakout of the surrounded units toward common centers. And the idea was to build up strong enough groups so they could fight their way to the perimeter."
"You were actually giving up the original sites?"
Orsip looked at the military overseer with an expression of offended disbelief. Moffus looked back coldly.
I'm telling you all this in detail so you'll understand it wasn't the usual matter of slaughtering a Molk in a stall, and so you'll be ready in case you run into anything. I'm telling you we had a rough tossing around in the beginning. Maybe you'll have a better idea when I tell you one of our northern groups of initial landing parties ran into this routine. The natives vaporized the center of each site with a nuclear bomb, contained the troops remaining in each site with minimum forces, then switched a heavy reserve from one landing party to the next, slaughtering them one after the other in succession. This wasn't brilliance on their part. This was their usual level of performance.
Horsop swallowed and looked serious. Moffus noted Horsop's reaction and nodded.
I'm no more used to being on the defensive than you are, and I can assure you I didn't enjoy a minute of it. But that's what we were up against. We managed to recover just one large group, about 18% of the original landing parties, then we pulled back into our perimeter under heavy attack. We had to bring the fleet down into the atmosphere to get at their communications. At that, the ships took losses of better than 1 in 5 despite the meteor guards. It was touch and go for 3 weeks. Then we got the edge, and by the end of the month, we had them hamstrung. Then we had some terrific fighting when we broke out of the defensive perimeter, but we won. At the end, we crushed them piecemeal.
How long did this take? Asked Horsip.
127 of the planet's days, said Moffus. Their day is roughly the same length as a day on Centra.
I see, said Horsip. And 10 to 12 days is considered average.
Averages don't count with something worse than Centralis II.
Horsip looked out at the planet, growing big as the landing boat swung closer. As he watched, he saw a region of pits and craters, a part of the globe that looked as if an angry giant had beat on it with a sledgehammer. He turned away, as if to change the subject.
What, he asked, do these humanoid natives look like?
A lot like us. They have a pair of anterior and a pair of posterior appendages, one head, eyes, ears, and nose. They walk upright and have opposable thumbs on the anterior appendages.
Any significant marking differences?
Moffus swallowed.
A few.
Good, said Horsip, relaxing a bit. That will save us the trouble of marking them.
When Moffus remained quiet, Horsip turned impatiently.
Well, don't just sit there. Enumerate them. What are the differences?
A bigger skull, said Moffus, with a larger brow and a less prominent nose. The females are practically hairless over the greater portion of their bodies, and so are the males, though in less degree.
Very good, said Horsip, nodding approval. What else?
The vestigial tail is almost completely absorbed. There's no visible stump at all, and the head is set more nearly erect on the body.
Splendid! Yes, very good indeed. Horsip looked vastly pleased. You realize the implications.
I don't see anything good about it, said Moffus.
Oh, come, man, said Horsip. You've had a difficult experience, but don't let it distort your values. This is a propitious start for planetary integration. These folks are self-marked by nature. We'll have no mixed-race trouble here, nor any of the usual marking difficulties either.
Orsa paused in thought, snapped his fingers, and added,
For instance, look at the words that apply to these natives. Big-headed, hairless, flat-nosed.
But they aren't flat-nosed.
What does that matter? Didn't you say their noses were smaller?
Well, yes, but not flat.
Horsip waved his hand.
Never mind that. We'll call them flat-nosed. Now let's see. Big-headed, hairless, flat-nosed. Wasn't there another...
Tailless,
supplied Moffus with enthusiasm.
Yes, tailless. Well...
Orsip leaned back, and a smile of creative enjoyment crossed his face.
We'll call them puff-skulled, hairless, flat-nosed lop-tails. Let's see any of our rowdy young bloods try to mate with them after that.
And they will,
said Moffus tonelessly.
But not officially, said Horsip, and that's what counts.
He looked down with pleasurable anticipation at the planet grown large beneath them. He rubbed his hands.
Well, he said, this is going to be pleasant work. A treat, Moffus.
Moffus shut his eyes as if to ease the pain.
I hope so, he said.
A strong guard of heavily armed soldiers awaited them in the landing area, itself ringed by several formidable lines of spike bar barriers, thickly sewn with leaping mine tripwires and covered by deeply dug-in splat gun emplacements. Horsip looked the defenses over curiously as he walked with Moffus to a heavily armored ground car. He noted that these soldiers carried out their orders readily enough, but without a certain verve usual on newly conquered planets.
Trouble?
He asked. Moffus glanced around uneasily.
Roving bands, he said. You think you've got them wiped out, and they pop up again somewhere else.
And they got into the ground car, an order was shouted outside, and the convoy began to move off. It wound out onto the road like a giant chuffing snake, moving jerkily as gaps opened and closed between vehicles. The going was bumpy till they got out onto the main road, then the cars moved smoothly along. At this stage, Horsip raised up to peer out a shuttered slit in the side of his vehicle. For 100 yards back from the side of the road, the vegetation was a burnt black. He scowled. Moffus read his thoughts.
Yes, clearing the roadside is an unusual precaution, but it's either that or get plastered with a can of inflammable liquid when you go by in the car.
Such an unnecessary width might indicate fear to the natives.
Moffus suppressed a snort. Horsip looked at him coldly.
Isn't that so?
Maybe, said Moffus. And maybe it indicates fear to a mulk when you put heavier bars on his stall. But the main idea is not to get gored.
We've already conquered these loptails.
Some of them don't know it yet. That's the trouble.
We won't convince them by being frightened.
We won't convince them by being dead either.
Horsip looked at Moffus coldly. His heavy brows came together and he opened his mouth. There was a dull boom from somewhere up ahead. Their car slowed suddenly, swerved, and then rolled forward so fast they were thrown hard back against the cushions. Something spanged against the side of the car. The snapping whack of a splat gun sounded up ahead, was joined by others, and rose to a crescendo as they raced forward and passed to one side of the uproar. Acrid fumes momentarily filled the car, making Horsip cough and his eyes run. Somewhere in the background there was an unfamiliar hammering thud that jarred Horsip's nerves. There was another explosion, and another, now well to the rear. Then the car slowed with a loud squeal from the machinery. Horsip was thrown forward, then slammed back hard as the car raced ahead again. As they settled into a fast, steady run, he turned to Moffus with a thoughtful frown.
How much farther do we have to go?
We should be about a quarter of the way.
Horsip sat, pale and thoughtful, beside Moffus, who sat, pale and gloomy, all the way to Horsip's new headquarters. The site of the new headquarters was not well chosen to convey the effect of untouchable superiority. The site consisted of a large, blackened mountain with a concrete tunnel entrance at the base. The mountain bristled with air defense cannons, was pocked and lined with shell holes, trenches, bunkers, and spike bar barriers. Around the tunnel entrance at the base, the barriers, cannon, and splat gun emplacements were so thick as to excite ridicule. Horsip was about to comment on it when he noted a huge thing like a monster turtle some 150 yards from the entrance. He felt the hair on his neck, back, and shoulders bristle.
What's that?
Moffus peered out the slit.
One of the humanoids traveling forts.
Horsip stared at the long, thick cannon that pointed straight at the tunnel entrance. He swallowed.
Is it disarmed?
The ground car's armor plating suddenly seemed very thin.
It is, isn't it?
Moffus said. Not exactly. Our engineers are studying it.
You don't mean the humanoids are still in control of it?
Oh, no, said Moffus. The concussion from our bombardment apparently killed them. Our experts are inside it, trying to figure out the mechanism.
Oh.
Horsip, as his angle of view changed, saw an armored ground car gradually come into sight, parked near the alien fort. He damned himself for a scare. Of course, the thing was disarmed, but he could not help noticing how ineffectual the ground car looked beside it. He cleared his throat.
How many of those, moving forts did the humanoids have?
Hundreds of them, said Malthus.
They rode in silence through the massive concrete entrance, and Horsa felt an unexpected sense of relief as the thick layer of earth, rock, and cement intervened between himself and the alien world. They rode downward for a long distance, then got out of the ground car. Moffat showed Horsip around his new headquarters, which consisted of a large suite of rooms, comfortably fitted out. Several outer offices with files, clerks, and thick-bound volumes of maps and data, and a private inner office paneled in dark wood, with Horsip's desk and chair on a raised dais, and a huge flag of Sentra hanging behind it. Horsip looked everything over in complete silence. Then he looked again around the private office at the desk, dais, and flag. He cleared his throat.
Let's go into my suite. Do you have the time?
I suppose so, said Malthus gloomily. There isn't a great deal I can do anyway.
Horsip looked at him sharply, then led the way back to his suite. They sat down in a small study, then Horsip got up, scowling intently, and began to pace the floor. Moffus looked at him curiously.
Moffus, said Horsip suddenly, you haven't told me the whole story.
Moffus looked startled.
Go on, said Horsip. Let's have it.
I've summarized.
You've left out pieces. Perhaps you've told me the facts and left out interpretations. We need it all.
He faced Moffus and pinned him with his gaze.
Well, said Moffus, looking uncomfortable.
You're my military deputy,
said Horsip, his eyes never leaving Moffus.
You and I must work together, each supplying the other's lacks. The first rule of planetary integration is to apply the maximum available force, in line with itself. If you apply force in one direction, and I apply force in another direction, the result will be less than if we both apply force in the same direction. That can be proved. Now, he said, you have had a difficult time. You hit with all your strength, and the blow was blunted. The natives showed considerable low cunning in using the brute force at their disposal. Because we are accustomed to swift victories, the slowness of your success discouraged you. I was somewhat surprised at the situation myself, at first. However, said Horsip, his voice swelling, a Molk is a Molk no matter how many bars he kicks off his stall. He may put up a struggle. It may take 20 times as long as usual to strap his neck to the block and slam the axe through. But when he's dead, he's just as dead as if it was over in a minute. Right?
Truth,
said Moffus, looking somewhat encouraged.
All right, said Horsip, pacing. Now, we've got the Molk into the stall, but apparently we're having some little trouble getting his head in the straps. Now, we can't strap a Molk in the dark, Moffus. The horns will get us if we try it. We've got to have light. You've got to light up the beast for me with the lantern of knowledge, Moffus, or I can't do my part. How about it?
Well,
said Moffus, looking interested and sitting forward on the edge of his chair.
I'm willing, now you put it that way, but where should I start?
Start anywhere, said Horsip.
Moffus cleared his throat and looked thoughtful.
Well, for one thing, he said at last, there's this piecemeal filing down they're doing to us.
He hesitated.
Go on, prompted Horsip. Talk freely. If it's important, tell me.
Well,
said Moffus,
it doesn't seem important, but take that trip from the landing boat to here. That wasn't a long trip, yet they knocked out at least one ground car. If it was the same as other trips like it, they would have put 15 men out of action and 3 ground cars at least. Suppose we have 300 men and 50 ground cars we can spare as escort between here and the landing boat place. Each time, they're likely to get hit once at least. It seems like just a small battle, not even a battle, just a brush with some diehard natives. But in 2 trips, we've lost 1 man out of 10 and 1 car out of 8.
Moffus paused, frowning.
And the worst of it is, we can't put it down. It's like a little cut that won't stop bleeding. If it just happens here, it would be bad enough. But it happens everywhere and anywhere that we don't have everything screwed down tight.
But, said Horsip, see here. Why don't you gather together 5,000 men and scour that countryside clean? Then you'll have an end to that. Then take those 5,000 men and clean out the next place.
He grew a little excited.
That's what they did to our landing parties, isn't it? Why not spring their own trap on them?
Moffus looked thoughtful.
We tried something like that earlier, when all this started, but the wear on the ground cars was terrific. Moreover, they moved only a few scores of men, and we had to move thousands. It was wearing us out. Worse yet, as they only had small bands in action, we couldn't always find them. We'd end up with thousands of men milling around in a little field and no humanoids. Then, from somewhere else, they'd fire into us.
Moffus shivered.
We tried to bring the whole army to bear on them, but it was like trying to shoot insects with a cannon. It didn't work.
Well, said Horsip, that was too bad. But still, you had the right idea, but you overdid it.
I wouldn't be surprised, said Moffus. None of us were in very good form by then.
Horsip nodded. But look here. Take 5,000 men. Break them up into units of, say, 500 each. Train the units to act alone or with others. Take 6 of the units and send them to troubled places. Hold the other 4 in your hand, ready to put them here or there as needed.
Moffus looked thoughtful.
It sounds good. But what if on their way to the trouble place, these men get fired on?
Horsip suppressed a gesture of irritation.
Naturally, the 500 would be split up into units. Say it was 10 units of 50 men each. 1 50-man unit would clean out the nest of snakes, and the rest would go on. When they were finished, the unit that had stopped would go after the rest.
Moffus nodded.
Yes, it sounds good.
What's wrong, then? Demanded Horsip.
The natives' stitching gun, said Moffus dryly.
The which? Said Horsip.
Stitching gun, said Moffus. It has a single snout that the darts move into from a traveling belt, like ground cars on an assembly line. The snout spits them out one at a time, and they work ruin on our men. If this 500-man team you speak of was hit on the road, and just 50 men from it tried to beat the natives, we'd probably lose all 50. The only way to win would be to stop the whole 500 and let the men fire at them from inside the ground cars.
But listen, said Horsip, just how many natives would they be fighting?
20, maybe.
Horsip did a mental calculation.
Then you mean one of their men is worth 2 to 3 of ours?
In this kind of fighting, yes.
Horsip made a howling sound in his throat, let out the beginning of a string of oaths, and cut them off.
I'm sorry, said Moffus. I know how you feel.
All right, said Horsip angrily, raising his hand and making gestures as if brushing away layers of gathering fog. Let's get back to this stitching gun. It only shoots 1 dart at a time. How does that make it better than our splat gun that can shoot up to 25 darts at a time?
I don't understand it exactly, said Moffus, but it has something to do with the way they fight. And then, too, the stitching gun shoots the darts out fast. It shoots a stream of darts. If the first one misses, the humanoid moves the gun a little and maybe the next one strikes home. If not, he moves it a little more. This time, 5 or 6 darts hit our man and down he goes. Now the humanoid looks around for someone else and starts in on him. Meanwhile, another humanoid is feeding belts of darts into the gun.
But our splat guns, said Horsip, exasperatedly. What are they doing all this time?
They're heavy, said Marfus, and it takes a little while to get them into action. Besides, the enemy, I mean the humanoids, have had all night to set their gun up and hide it, and now they pick out their target at will. We have to stop the vehicles to go into action, and that isn't the worst either.
Now what?
The splat gun operators can't see the enemy. I mean, the humanoids. They'll be dug in and concealed. When the gunners do realize where they are, as likely as not the splat guns can't get at them, because there's nothing but the snout of the stitching gun to fire at. It's likely to be someone firing from inside the ground cars that finally picks off the humanoids.
Horsip looked at Marfus thoughtfully.
Are there many more difficulties like this?
The planet is full of them, said Marfus. It seems like heaven compared to what it was when the full-scale fighting was going on. But when you get right down to it, it's hard to see whether we've made any headway since then or not. The maddening part of it is, we can't seem to get a grip on the thing.
He hesitated, then went on.
It's too much like trying to wear down a rock with dirt. The dirt wears away instead.
Horsip nodded, made an effort, and looked confident.
Never mind that, Morpheus. You've got the Mulk in the stall for us. He's still kicking, but that just means there's so much the more meat on him.
I hope so, said Morpheus.
You'll see, said Horsip. Once planetary integration gets started on the job.
The staff of planetary integration came down on the planet the next day. Soon they were coming in from the landing field in groups. They were talkative people, waving their hands excitedly, their voices higher pitched than most. Their faces were smug, and in their eyes was a glint of shrewdness and cunning as they regarded the new world around them. Morpheus did not look especially confident at their arrival, but Horsip brimmed over with energy and assurance. He began to put the problems to them.
First, what to do about the ambushing on the road?
The answers flew thick as dust in summertime.
Small forts and splat gun nests could be built along the chief roads. Light patrols could scour the fields alongside to seek out the loptails before they got their guns in place. Strips of leaping mines could be laid alongside the roads at a distance, so the loptails would have to cross them to do any damage. Light airplanes could drop explosives on them. The problem was easy.
What about the stitching gun?
Simple. Capture as many as possible from the loptails and teach our men how to use them. Find the factories that made them and induce the manufacturer to make more. And the same for the place that made their darts. Minor details of the gun's outward appearance could be changed and a big seal attached reading, Official Centrist Stitching Gun.
Now, the big question. How to end this creeping war? The planetary integration staff had a simple answer for that one. Every time a human was killed, 10 of the loptails should lose their lives. If that didn't stop the foolishness, then 11 loptails should die. If it still went on, then 12 loptails.
Each time the ratio was raised, there should be an impressive announcement.
Placards should be scattered over the country saying, If you murder a Centrin, you kill 10 of your own kind. The loptails should be offered full humanoid equality, local self-government, and all the other inducements, on the condition that they were peaceful and disciplined the rowdy elements that were causing trouble. Horsip gave the necessary commands to set the machinery in motion. For a full week, everything worked splendidly. Horsip was enjoying a hot-scented bath when Morpheus came charging in. Morpheus had a raised black and blue welt on his head, his uniform was torn open at the chest, and he looked furious. Horsip put his hands over his ears.
"Stop that foul-mouthed cursing!" said Horsip. "I can't understand a word you're saying!"
Morpheus shivered all over convulsively.
"I say, your integration program isn't working, that's what I say!"
"Why not?"
Horsip looked stunned.
"How do I know why not? Nothing works on this stinking planet!"
Horsip clambered out of the tub into the drip pan.
What's wrong? What happened?
I'll tell you what's wrong. We built the small forts and splat gun nests just as you told us to. The crews in them have been living a horrible life. They're harassed from morning to night. Just what is the advantage, I'd like to know, of having 500 men strung out in 24 little packets that have to be supplied separately instead of all together where you can do something with them? And then, this stitching guy...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?